Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Shreveport filmmaker and writer William Joyce, whose new book and Oscar award-winning film are both called The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. Bill Joyce is one of my favorite authors and illustrators and filmmakers. Newsweek called him one of the top 100 people to watch in the new millennium, and are we watching? Just like we were when we saw him win an Academy Award February 26, 2012, for his animated short film, The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. This conversation was recorded after a screening of that film, June 22nd at NOCA, to celebrate the publication of that story in book form. Bill Joyce is the author of more than 50 books.
Of all our Louisiana writers, I think Bill Joyce is our great enchanter. Whether it is the epic journey of Santa Claus, the sweet, sweet springtime of Bentley and Egg, the fantastic escape of A Day with Wilbur Robinson, and now the fantastic flying books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, I don't think any of us will ever look at a book again without imagining it taking flight. So we feel very lucky to have you here tonight.
Well, thank
to
you. Talk thank you for you. Having me.
Now, this story of a man who loses everything, his words, his life, his books, and he's brought to himself by books, had its roots in a very real experience of yours. Talk about that a bit.
Well, it's a lot of experiences, really.
Right.
I mean, I never know where books are going to come from, and they just sort of pop into my head. And sometimes I don't even know why until I'm doing them or I'm done with them or my wife explains them to me later. But this one was kind of had an interesting genesis, and that I was going to see a colleague at HarperCollins who had been my publisher. And this fella had been there since, he'd been there for 50 years. His name was Bill Morris. He'd been working there since they're called Harper Brothers, before they're even Harper and Row. And he was one of those great old gents of publishing. And so when I first started, I mean, 2 weeks out of college, he was one of the mentors that back in that period of time, publishers really like sort of gave their young authors apprenticeships in a way. I was given, you know, little books to do for several years, and so I could kind of figure things out. And Bill was one of those guys. And he was consistent throughout my whole career and for many, many people in children's publishing's career. We always thought that he would work until he died, and that's pretty much what happened. He got sick, and he knew he didn't have much time. And so I decided to go up and see him before it was too late, and he was amenable to that. He was kind of a quiet. He was very, very funny in a dry sort of way, but he kept his life, his personal life, like outside of publishing, like to himself. And so I'd never seen his apartment in all the years I'd known him. I didn't know where he lived. In fact, I expected this kind of like brownstone kind of place, like something out of the short. But it was he lived in the first I.M. Pei designed building in Manhattan. It was a super sleek, modern thing that was built in the 60s. Did not see that coming at all. So I went up to his room and his apartment, and there he was, and there was nothing but books from floor to ceiling in every room. There's hardly any furniture in this place. And then he was in a hospital bed, and there was a nurse there. And it was just so curious. You know, I've always seen him, and he always was dapper. And he was a little guy. He was barely 5 feet tall, but there he was. He looked even smaller in that bed. And we had a really great visit. But on the way there, in the plane, this title came into my head. So I was thinking about Bill, and I was thinking about the history that he represented for me and for so many others, and that there was a part of publishing that would be gone, you know, with guys like him. So it was just on my mind. And then this title, and that's how it happens sometimes. It's just a phrase. And whatever weird curly cues of logic sometimes filter around in here, it just came out, The Fantastic Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore. It just tripped off of my brain onto my tongue and then down my arm and the pen and onto this crummy pad of paper lined. Like, I didn't even have a decent pad with me. This was like notebook paper, like you would use in high school or something. And so I started drawing little images and writing this little parable. And it was virtually the same as the book that you have in your hands now, just without the lines on it. And and I got to tell him, you know, I said, you know, Bill, I wrote this thing on the plane that I hope, because he was kind of a salty old guy. And I didn't know if he would, like, this would be too sappy for him to have done this. But I said, you know, I'm going to tell you something, and I'm going to read this to you. And if it bothered him, he didn't let me know. He had this, like, great jack-o'-lantern grin, and he just smiled and said, I really like that.
So,
yeah, it was nice. And then he died, like, 3 days later. So I told, like, Colleen Sally was one of the first people I told, the great New Orleans storyteller, because she was good friends with Bill. And I told her I'd written this, and I read it to her over the phone. And she, you know, Colleen was not... reserved, you know. And David, her son, called it not cuss words of endearment. It's
expletives
of endearment. Yes, Colleen had lots of expletives of endearment after she quit weeping copiously because she was very operatic. And then when she got her voice back, then she told me that was the expletive best thing I'd ever expletive done. And if I didn't hurry up and expletive finish it, she would kick my expletive this and that. But, you know, sometimes books just take a while. And even if you know, your fire's in your belly for that first blast of...
Yeah.
And, like, then Hurricane Katrina happened. And it just... It was such a strange time. I mean, I don't have to tell you guys, but it just shook things up for me. I mean, seeing what happened afterwards, seeing how bad things went, and we had 30,000 people come into Shreveport in a day. And then in the same couple of days, I still can't believe this happened so fast. The head of the New Orleans Art Commission Society, whatever you call it, had relocated up to Shreveport, and they were running that organization out of Shreveport. And so we had a meeting with her, with our regional arts council, and we voted unanimously to funnel all our funds and all our efforts towards helping the artists and the people in New Orleans. And in that meeting, on that day, which was, I think, 2 days after the storm, we decided that we would send photographers and oral historians into the shelters. And if people want to tell their story, we will listen. Because it just felt like that was something we needed to hear and find out. And to take their portraits so that there'd be a record, you know? I just felt like, yeah, Here's your story and here's you. And when they started to tell their stories, you could just see that it helped, you know, just to tell what had happened to them. It was just galvanizing or something to just let somebody know, just to say it out loud. And you could see the spark of life kind of come back in their faces. And that really affected me. And then seeing kids... Because there's so many kids, and they're in these shelters with 18,000 cots, yeah, you know, laid out, and there's no privacy, and there's nothing that you knew that was comforting or home-like. There's nothing else for kids to do in these places. I mean, there's no television, there's nothing. So you give them a book, and so I'd see in this sea of displacement and everything that didn't feel comforting and safe, you'd see a kid with a book. And it was like there was this cone of protection around them. They were lost in that book. And they'd taken refuge in that book, that book was, you know, solace to them. And I just went, books will never die, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I just don't think they ever will. There's all this talk about, is the book doomed? And, you know, I've been working in all these different media and medium that expand on what books do. But I don't see any of that as a threat. I just see it as a new way to get a story. But the book is too powerful and too strong and too pure, and it works too well for it to go away. So I think we all need to just quit worrying about that and go buy some books.
Thank God.
So all that started to funnel into the story.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I think that you capture so beautifully in this film is the way Katrina took away a story from each person, but at the same time gave them one. That remarkable moment when the letters are flying out of the book, and the remarkable moment when he begins to write again. It's a really lovely way to capture that.
Well, I hope that's what happened. I mean, mm-hmm, you know, that's what I, in my mind, you know, it was like, how do you explain this loss, and how do you illustrate what may have happened, what in best cases happened, that your story is wiped clean. And that was one of the other things that I saw, like it's coming down to New Orleans after the storm, and you'd see this kind of weird cakey mud and just clots of books. You know, they seemed to like drift together or something. Yeah. And you're like, this is people's libraries. These are every book they had in their lives, and they're all merged together now in this gray muck. And so you've got to start your story over in a way. I mean, everything was wiped clean. So that he was able to do that was the hopeful thing that I was trying to get across.
I want to show you one of my most treasured possessions, which is a card from Bill after he won the Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival. And he wrote me, "Susan, thanks so much for coming to the ceremony, and you really put the fire in my belly to get Morris Lessmore finished. Thank you."
Thank you.
And then he wrote, "Though Billy's booger is calling." And there are flying books, and one of the flying books is Billy's booger. Bill has been talking about this book for a very long time, and I think you should tell us that story.
Sure. every author has his beginnings, and they're not all auspicious. I can't remember, the second grade or the fourth grade. I think it's a fourth, because I read my school records at a certain point, and the fourth grade teacher was the one that just said, "Odd child," for my... and she summed up her entire experience of my year with her with those two words. So I think it was her that year that I wrote my first book in answer to a contest that they had at my school to see what kid could write the best kid's book. And I had what I thought was a sterling idea, and I completed it, and my peers seemed to like it, and I felt very confident that I would win the award. And the name of it was Billy's Booger. And it was an autobiographical piece, a memoir, if you will. And then it was about a kid named Billy who was terrible at math. You're looking at it. But here's where things diverge. He gets hit in the head by a meteorite one day, and that meteorite gives his booger superpowers. And they're good at math. So they live up in his nose, you know, and whenever he has like really tough math homework, they, you know, sort of whisper in his sinuses, you know, "Yeah, carry the two," you know. But whenever there's some crime that needs fighting, the boogers will fly forth from his nose. And Billy is sort of, because he's their fortress of solitude and sidekick, you know, he has to go along, and they're secret superheroes. So when they're done fighting crime and they need to, you know, hide out so nobody knows where they are, they go back up in Billy's nose, where they, you know, live in their fortress of nasal solitude. And so it was done entirely in green crayon. But you can see I have a kind of affinity for messing with color here in Morris and even back then. And I thought that was a clever twist. And so they announced the winners I didn't win first. I didn't win second. I didn't third. And not even an honorable mention. And I was really just like, what? Yeah. I mean, you know, all the kids in the class liked it. You know, they laughed, you know, and it kind of made up for, you know, how bad I was at tetherball. And I was just kind of baffled. And then we got back to our classroom after that assembly. And then there's over the intercom, it said, "Would William Joyce please report to the principal's office immediately?" And I was like, oh, they remember my award, you know. And so I'm strutting down the hall to the principal's office, and I see, oh, my parents are in there. Oh, they invited them to this private ceremony with the principal. And I walked in, and they're like, oh, where's my trophy? And sat down, and the principal had my book on the desk. I'm like, oh, he's read it, you know. So once I got settled, and it was just like, he brandished it. He actually like held it up like if there was a book that needed burning, this was it. Oh. And he's like, "Mr. and Mrs. Joyce, your son has been drawing boogers in school." And my mom shot back immediately, "Oh, you should see the stuff he draws at home." And so I had to promise not to draw that in school anymore. So, but I had a sequel that got me in trouble later, Gomer's Pyle. And
and last, but by no means least, Bill is working on this fabulous, fabulous series, the Guardians of Childhood series. Tell us how that's coming along. I love it.
Thank you.
I love it, Bill.
Thank you. I started it when my kids were little and they were asking about Santa Claus and Tooth Fairy and all those guys. And I was like, I didn't have any good answers. And so I'm like, well, this is what I do. And so I did some research and I started compiling their histories. And I found that they were vast, you know, heroic characters, that they didn't just bring toys or at Christmas, or they didn't just take a tooth and give you some change or something. They were valiant heroes, masters of huge domains, and they fight this never-ending battle with the boogeyman, whose real name is Pitch. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on for centuries, and they started with the Man in the Moon was the first one of the Guardians, and then he found these emissaries on Earth to help him keep the children of Earth safe from Pitch and to keep their dreams happy and bright. And so I've worked on it off and on for 20-something years now. But it got too big, and I got daunted. I was like, I don't know where to start, and they're all going to be hard, and it's going to take forever, and you know, and I tend to get distracted. And so finally, DreamWorks Animation heard about it, and they asked me to tell them about it, and I did. And they went, God, we love this. We want to make a movie out of it, and you can, you know, help guide it. And I'm like, well, the deal is, and a number of people had tried to buy the rights to it over the years, even Pixar. And I said, look, I'm doing these books, and it's like there's going to be a series of novels, and there's going to be a series of picture books. And so if you do this, you have to know that I'm not giving that up, because they all want to control, Hollywood studios want to control everything. And a lot of them just said, no, that's a deal breaker. And I went, well, fine. You know, I'm doing these books. So yeah. I'm not going to just let you guys do the movie. This story is bigger than that. And I've been working on it too long. And movies can get either not made or turn out bad. And I'm not leaving this idea up to those possibilities. I might not do a great job, but at least I'll do the job I want to do. So you have to go along with that. And I don't even want the movie to be based on these books. I want the movie to be something separate. I want these books to set up what the movie would be. I want to tell the origin stories of these icons of childhood: the Man in the Moon, the Sandman, the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, Jack Frost, Santa Claus, and lately, actually, Mother Goose has gotten in there, and so has Mother Nature, and Lady Luck's kind of peeking around the corner. And but the movie will, you know, take place after the books, like 150 years after the books. It's, you know, when they've become established. And all the other studios are like, what? Are you crazy? And I'm like, maybe, but that's what I want to do. And DreamWorks said, that sounds great.
Yay.
And I was like, you're kidding, you know? And so the great thing is, so they start the movie and I'm working on the movie, but now I have to do the books.
Yay, you know,
and so it's one of those things that's like having that ticking clock, you know, or gun to my head made me sit down and finally do these things and just roll up my sleeves and say, all right, I'm going to get this done. And so the movie comes out on November the 21st of this year in 3D and all that kind of stuff. And Jude Law is the boogeyman, and he's really good. And he's much better as a scary guy. And Alec Baldwin is Santa Claus. And he's good. He's, because he's, you know, and Hugh Jackman is the Easter Bunny. And
perfect, perfect.
He's from way down under, as we say. And he's actually hysterical. And Chris Pine is Jack Frost, and Alia Fisher is the Tooth Fairy. And the Sandman is mute.
Ah.
But by the time the movie comes out, I'll have published 5 books of the series. So I'll have done the Man in the Moon picture book. And The Sandman will be coming out in the fall. We finished that a few weeks ago. And then the novel of Nicholas St. North. That's Santa Claus's real name, Nicholas St. North. And then the novel about E. Astor Bunnymund, which is the real name of the Easter Bunny. And who, by the way, is a puka, a 6-foot-tall relative of the guy from Harvey.
Harvey, exactly.
Yes. And that's why Harvey's, you know, you don't ever see him, because they only let themselves be seen by who they want. And the Tooth Fairy novel will be out, or her name is Queen Toothiana. And I'll keep doing these books over the next few years with Simon & Schuster. So it's all coming together finally now.
And they are so beautiful. They will change the way you think of these figures forever. I mean, I remember just seeing the sketch of the Tooth Fairy in Shreveport once when we were visiting, and I've never forgotten it. I mean, that's the way I think of the Tooth Fairy.
Well,
now.
She's changed since then.
Oh, no.
Oh, she looks
crushed.
She looks even better, though.
I'm crushed.
No. No, you're going to love it. She's great.
I'm sure I will. And you'll get another Oscar, I hope.
You know. Thank you.
Oh.
You know, they're not after dinner mints.
No. Did you deserve
it? I'm really happy with that one, you know. If I was telling somebody, if another one falls out of the sky, I'm going to catch it. But
all right.
Thank you for that sentiment and...
And if anybody can do it, you can do it. Let's thank Bill Joyce.
Oh, no. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Richard Ford reads from and signs Canada, his new novel, Thursday, June 28th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. This event was rescheduled from Tuesday, June 26th, because that night, Richard Ford will be appearing on The Colbert Report. Susan Tucker and Beth Willinger discuss and sign Newcomb College, 1886 to 2006, Higher Education for Women in New Orleans, Thursday, June 28th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. There will be story times every Wednesday and Saturday at 11:30 a.m. during the summer at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Patty Friedman discusses and signs her new book, No Take Backs, Saturday, June 30th at noon at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Ellie James signs Broken Illusions, Saturday, June 30th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, the Bayou Soul Writers Conference, which was begun by novelist Clarence Nero last year, is back for a second outing July 5th through 6th at the Holiday Inn downtown and the New Orleans Public Library. Among the impressive list of headliners are Omar Tyree, Victoria Christopher Murray, Mary Monroe, Julie Kane, Jed Horn, and Victor Laval. For more information and to register, check out bswconference.com. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org or email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶